So, I looked up the word fetter in the dictionary and in some other places. And to fetter something is to restrain from motion, access, or progress. So that's the verb form of it. But also there's something called a fetter. And basically a fetter is some sort of device that they put around typically a leg, because fet and foot are coming from the same old English roots. And then it's attached to a chain and attached to the wall or attached to a tree or something like that. I actually, when I was in India traveling with my teacher 5 years ago, we were in South Indian Karnataka, and we were invited to the house of one of his wealthier merchant disciples. And in South India, if you're wealthy, you have an elephant. I mean, that's what people, because they must transportation and to haul things and do all kinds of stuff. And this elephant was in the backyard of this guy's house and had a big metal ring around with one of its back legs and a huge chain that attached it to a big tree. So this elephant was fettered. It couldn't move. It couldn't go where it wanted to do. It was restrained. Now, the word fetter, you'll also see translated in a different way in some translations. You'll see the word defilement. The same is just two different ways that this Pali word is translated. I much prefer the word fetter to the word defilement. So if you're reading different translations, be aware of that. A defilement has this sort of shaking finger, oh, there's something really wrong with you sort of vibe to it. And a fetter is just like, oh, I'm stuck. I'm held back. I'm stuck somehow. It doesn't have a pejorative vibe to it, I don't think. And so I actually prefer the word fetter, which is sort of partly why I picked this particular sutta. And I'm not going to go into huge detail of the sutta, though I am going to read some pieces of it and talk about it. Now I want to talk much more broadly about fetters and what a fetter is and what these fetters mean and how we can skillfully work with them. So basically, many of the sutras, someone has come to the Buddha for instruction. And in this case, he's just hanging out with some of his senior disciples. And the Buddha says, "Do you remember the five lower fetters as taught by me?" So he's asking, checking to see that his students understand what he said in previous time. And so this is one of his students says, "Venerable sir, I remember identity view as a lower fetter taught by the Blessed One. I remember doubt as a lower fetter taught by the Blessed One. I remember adherence to rules and observances as taught by the lower one, Blessed One. I remember sensual desire as a lower fetter taught by the Blessed One. I remember ill will as a lower fetter taught by the Blessed One. It is in this way, Venerable Sir, that I remember the five lower fetters as taught by the Blessed One." So this disciple has sort of listed the five lower fetters. Identity view, the sense that I'm somebody, I'm separate from everything else, I have a separate identity. Big theme in Buddhist teachings. Doubt, which I'll talk more about. Adherence to rules and observances. Sensual desire. And ill will. So it is these, and these are all thought forms in a sense. These are all ways we end up thinking that fetter us, stop us from making progress and on the path. We can't go further along the path because we're held back by these fetters. The Buddha, however, goes on, and this is, I found this interesting. First, he's saying, "Would not the wanderers of other sects confute you with the simile of the infant For a young, tender infant lying prone does not even have the notion of identity. So how could identity view arise in him? Yet the underlying tendency of identity view lies within him. So he's saying, and he's going on with the other four, what he's saying is there's the sort of the outward expression of these, but there's also sort of this inherent, inborn pattern almost that all human beings have. Even a tiny baby, an innocent baby, has at some level these things that are will manifest as time goes on. And the interesting thing about these lower fetters is whole of the practice is in some sense learning how to identify them and work with them skillfully so we're not no longer fettered, no longer controlled by them. But we have to be careful because it's very easy to think, and this is what the Buddha is pointing to here and in a verse further on. He's saying basically, you know, we think because we don't act from the basis of identity view or doubt or, you know, the sensual desire, ill will, any of these things, we don't act in that way, then everything's okay. But actually, all of these fetters have sort of three layers to them. I suppose layers, there's the physical manifestations of them, which causes a lot of suffering for ourselves and others in the world. But there's also the mental, called the mental layer. There's like thinking about the thinking in patterns that go along with these patterns. And then, and this is the key thing, that at some level, there's also this energy that is purely latent. In other words, not acting on them right now, we're not thinking along those lines right now. Inherent in our mental process is the latent energy of these fetters that, surprise, surprise, at any moment just can pop up and now we're here we are, here we go again. So we keep thinking, I don't act from sensual desire. I'm not full. I don't act from doubt. So I must be okay. But often, though we're not acting out from those places, we're caught in the mental process of them, in thinking about them. And even more subtly, we forget that even if right now I'm not acting out from them or thinking along those lines, they're sort of like lurking in the background. They're just waiting for us to get, you know, there we are sitting innocently meditating, right? And our mind goes nice and still, calm. This is great. I'm just so calm and still right now. And pop, this latent tendency pops up and there we are trying to, where did that come from? But we are like, whoa. Yeah, but that's what happened. There is actually another sutta that's sort of related to this. And in this sutta, this is for those of you who are making notes, Majjhima Nikaya 56. This is a sutta where the Buddha is talking to someone. And in this case, he's actually talking to someone who's from not one of his students, but from a different sect. And remember, North India in this time was full of these different religious sects and different forms of practice. And so someone from a different sect who's come to dispute with the Buddha and debate with him. The interesting thing was, in those days, the rule was if you came and debated with the teacher, especially if you were a teacher from a different tradition, if you came and debated and lost the debate, then you had to become the guy who won the debate, his or her disciple. That was the, like, if you chose to debate with someone and you lost the debate, now you have to accept yourself as the student of the person you lost the debate to. So this is serious stuff. And in this, in the sutta, there's like many, many cases where it's always someone's coming to debate with the Buddha. And I get this guy, he's like, because he's really famous. So they, you know, I can get him to be my student, I'll be even more famous, right? And they all lose. None of them win. And all of them, there's this sort of formulaic thing at the end of almost most of these suttas where the person who's come to do the debate sort of declares that the Buddha is wonderful and he bows down to him mentally and he's his student. But just a little sidelight here. In this case, this is someone who's someone named Nupali, who's a Naganta. Now, the Nagantas were this very severe, believed in sect that believed in self-mortification, in punishing the body, basically. And there's modern versions of this in India that you can see today. There's a sect called the Jains in India today that are an offshoot of traditional Hindu, have a different tradition. But part of their thing is that if you're a Jain renunciate, you walk around with a broom. So anywhere you're walking, you're sweeping the path in front of you so you don't accidentally step on anything that's alive and kill it. Because that would be bad. You know, this would be like, I've killed something. I'm not supposed to kill him. And this, so this guy Upali comes and he basically says, you know, there's these three levels that things occur in. In the physical world, there's the, in the mental world, and then there's these sort of latent, this was also verbal world. And then there's the, you know, the mental latent area. And the Gantas say, you know, the worst of these, actually, let me read you this little verse here. The Naganta, Digpa Tapasi, has answered the recluse Gautama like a well-taught disciple who understands his teacher's dispensation rightly. What does the trivial mental rod count for in comparison with a gross bodily rod? On the contrary, the bodily rod is the most reprehensible for the performance of evil action, for the perpetration of evil action, and not so much the verbal rod and the mental rod. So he's saying the work you do is act from on an inappropriate place. And basically the rest of the sutta in this debate, the Buddha convinces him basically, no, it's really the other way around. Yeah, because everything starts from the mental level. Before we say something inappropriate, something harmful, something based on desire or ill will or doubt or any of these things, before we, that comes out in speech or we act it out in some way physically, it's always there mentally first. And it's the mental level that we have to change. If we can change the mental level, then the verbal level and the physical level change by themselves, because we don't have the mental thing. And this is the Buddha's emphasis over and over and over again on the importance of intention, the mental factor of intention. You know, the second noble truth is, you know, right intention, you know, wise intention. Because basically, what he said, if you act without intent, and something happens, like you step on a bug, there's no harm. You haven't done any harm and actually done anything wrong because you weren't acting from intention. It's only when you act from intention that the results of that action resound in your life. You know, on a karmic level, it's all like on a day-to-day level, life level. And so what the Buddha was getting across in this particular sutta, but also in many other places, constantly talking about how intentions are the impetus behind our words and actions. That's where the work to be done to break the fetters. I mean, we can, we could tie ourselves up and gag ourselves, and then I would never have to worry about acting or speaking in an incorrect way. But my mind would still be full, probably fuller, because I'm restrained that way. It was all kinds of total nonsense and unwholesome thoughts. So it's not that how we act and what we say isn't important. But it's like where we come from at the mental, that's where it really can be. There is another teaching in the Buddha that I'm sure some of you probably heard me speak of before. It's called the 10 unwholesome acts of body, speech, and mind. And so there's three acts of body, and there's four acts of speech, and then three acts of mind. The last act of mind is the biggest problem that creates all the others, is wrong view, not understanding, not seeing things. Because with wrong view, we form intentions to act and speak in certain ways that are unwholesome. But with correct view, the first step on the noble, on the Eightfold Path, then based on right view, we'll form correct intention to act and speak in a certain way. It's a different angle when I'm to things. I want to actually read. This is I'm going to go a little deeper into this idea. One of the places where we often get out of line on the mental level is at the subtle level of our perception. Think that our perception, our ability, perception is that mental function that basically something arises, we notice it. We have some sort of very subtle reaction to it called vedana, where we think it's pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. And then we go, the perceptive function is identifying that based on memories of other things. Like we identify, we hear a sound, we go, oh, that sounds like a crow, because we've heard a crow before and we know what a crow sounds like. That's perception function. And then after that comes oh, crows are really nasty birds. All those other things start to happen later. But it's perception that often misleads us, because we think our perceptions are really good. Like it's a natural human tendency to think that we perception is, I always see things very clearly. Actually, our perception is totally unreliable as a judging how things are. It just doesn't. It's not very, very effective. I want to read something here. This is from Joseph Goldstein from his book Mindfulness, and this is because, and this relates directly to these fetters I was just talking about. Our perceptions are also conditioned by the latent tendencies in our mind. So we think we see something. Part of it is because we want it to be a certain way, or we don't want it to be a certain way, or we have doubt that it's a certain way, and the fetters are arising. The habitual projections that color how we view ourselves and the world. For example, a common perception in meditation is that a pleasant sitting is good, and that a painful one is bad. Although we may know intellectually that this isn't true, this felt assessment comes from perceptions conditioned by the latent tendencies of desire and aversion. You know, two of the five we just talked about. What makes the Buddha's understanding of the mind so powerful is the recognition that because perceptions are conditioned by our mental habits, we can also train our perceptions in a way that supports happiness and freedom. In other words, we can start to see how just how we perceive things at that simple level of, oh, that's a crow. That if we really look at how we see those things, how perception works, we start to understand, oh, but did I get the crow because I like crows? I don't like crows. You know, I had a bad experience with the crow once. Every time I'm around crows like, since then, it's always been, oh my God, crows. You know, who knows what the reaction is. But if we have these latent tendencies that color our perceptions over and over and over again. So this is a very interesting place to work on the mental level to see these latent tendencies arise and take control. It's subtle, but it's an interesting place to explore in our practice because it's like, here's a way where we can clearly see, oh, look, there's my latent tendencies popping up in this odd place. You know, just because I heard a crow, which is just a simple thing that we heard. It's just a sound. But all of a sudden, the tendencies we have affect how we see it or hear it. Or smell it, or whatever the physical sense might be involved. This is a different way to think about our perceptions in the sense of practice, how we can look at them from a practice point of view. Anna Lyall also has, this is Anna Lyall's Bodhipatthana. This is a PhD thesis on the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the Buddha's instructions on meditation. And he's talking about what Joseph talked about in Analeo tends to be somewhat more analytic. I mean, this is a PhD thesis, so. Often these six senses are the object, and their objects occur in descriptions of the conditioning arising consciousness. An intriguing aspect of this conditional situation is the role that subjective influence plays in the perceptual process. So here we are talking about perception again. Experience, represented by the six types of consciousness, is the outcome of two determinant influences. The objective aspect on the one hand, that is the incoming sensory impression, and the subjective aspect on the other hand, namely the way in which these sense impressions are received and cognized, and that's how our perception functions. Supposedly objective perceptual appraisal is in reality conditioned by the subject as much as by the object. One's experience of the world is the product of an interaction between the subjective influence exercised by how one perceives the world and the objective influence exercised by various phenomena of the external world. Understood in this way, the fact that the instructions on meditation, directs awareness to each of these sense organs could have deeper implications in the sense of pointing to the need to recognize the subjective bias inherent in each process of perception. The influence of this subjective bias has a decisive effect on first stages of perception and can lead to the rising of a fetter. Such subsequent reactions are often based on qualities and attributes assumed to belong to the perceived object. In actual fact, these qualities and attributes are often projected on the object by the perceiver. So what he's saying is, I hear crow, I just hear that sound, my mind goes crow, and then all that energy I have about, oh, I don't like crows because they're dirty or they're souls of bad luck, whatever it is, who knows, some mental process I have about crows goes on top of the actual raw perception and colors and distorts it. And so this is a place where we can explore how subtly the mind can be distorted. Just because we think perception is just like, oh, it's just a function of the mind. It's always working just fine. Most of the time it's clouded. It's iffy. I find it, I hope I'm not boring you with this. I find this all totally fascinating. This is how our mind actually works. And it's like, what the Buddha kept coming back to is, if you can understand how the mind works, then you have a better chance of actually being able to work with these things, as opposed to just letting them overwhelm you and being controlled all the time. So I did want to take, I wanted to look at one more thing here. And this is the actual five fetters themselves that I read out earlier. I want to take a little bit of time looking at each of those. And the first of those was identity view. And once again, Joseph Goldstein, this is from his book, Insight Meditation, has something interesting to say here. This idea, identity view basically is saying, I have this view that I'm separate. I somehow think that I am somehow separate from everything else, as opposed to just totally, absolutely connected to everything else. This is in like the introductory stage of this book called Insight Meditation by Joseph Goldstein. The Buddha places great emphasis on uprooting one particular defilement in order to abandon the causes of suffering. This is considered the most dangerous, is the strong belief in and view of some permanent self. As long as our mind is afflicted by that wrong view, by that incorrect perception of things, it leads us on to problems to perform many other kinds of unwholesome actions. If we have a mistaken notion of I, then we need to defend it and gratify it. And thus many of our actions begin to revolve around this wrong view. The writer Wu Wei, never heard of him before, succinctly expressed this root defilement, elusive effect. It's like a dog barking up a tree that isn't there. Aphoristic, I think. Meditation purifies the mind of this most deeply conditioned defilement, which has caused so much suffering in our lives and which is the basic misperception of our existence. Through the power of mindful awareness, we get a sense, a taste of that, of what selflessness, absence of self, means. We understand it not theoretically or conceptually, but in the experienced freedom of the moment. And I'm going to come back to this idea later, but that's... Joseph, of course, cuts right to the chase. He says, this is the big one. You know, all these other things we think are problems, it's this problem we have where we think we're a separate self. This is the one we have to overcome. And so much of the Buddha's teaching and so much of the instructions he gives on meditation in various ways and forms all revolve around this problem, this fetter, the sense that somehow I'm separate. And here's the interesting thing. This is an interesting tidbit. So this identity view, the Buddha is sitting underneath the Bodhi tree. This is the night of his enlightenment, right? And what he said was, the last thing he had to let go of was a subtle sense of a separate identity. Yeah, the identity view fetter at the subtlest level. This is not like, we're not going to all take care of this tomorrow. Okay, this is deep and subtle, but it's something that we can be aware of, and we can see it in little moments and go, oh, I just got caught by my sense of I'm a separate self. And over time, we get to see it more deeply and deeply and more deeply. We'll come more to that. So the second of these things in the list, after identity view, is doubt. Often it's sometimes when people talk about doubt, they talk about three kinds of doubt. You know, doubt in the teachings, doubt in the teacher, and doubt in the self. In the sense of, oh, I can't do that. I'm not sure enough, smart enough, wise enough, good enough to actually meditate, let alone be able to ever see my identity view manifesting. You know, it's very easy to go to that those sorts of places. And the problem with doubt as a third is it's in some senses the most insidious, because it always seems so incredibly logical. You know, when doubt is speaking to you, you know, those little conversations you have in your mind, doubt is always the one that says, well, you know, this is the way it really is. I mean, you know, what's wrong with you to think it's not this way? You know, it has this sort of logical veneer that seems so easy to believe that it's easy to be caught by this fetter. And so we have to sort of watch for it in that sense. The basic antidotes to doubt, the two that are most spoken traditionally in terms of breaking this fetter, is to go back to your original intention. Why am I doing this practice in the first place? What was the, because that original intention is very pure. There's a purity to the intention. And study. Oh, here we are studying again. But it's like, that's a way to break doubt, is to study and say, oh, you start to sort of study a lot, sort of see, oh, wait, yeah, I can see how that's sort of what was going on here, or that's what's going on. You know, and you start to see how that doubt is arising out of habits of the mind. And but that's a practice of study itself. That's part of why study is so important in this tradition. The next of the five was adherence to rules and observances. Being a good boy and a good girl, right? I'm going to follow all the rules. I'm going to do what everybody, what the world says. I'm going to act and speak and be the way everybody says I should be. And this might be based on our culture, based on our upbringing, based on our nationality, based on all kinds of things. And all of these things, all adherences to rules and observances, if you start to look what they are, underneath, always underneath, is an element of fear. Like, I have to follow the rules, or I'm going to get, you know, kicked out of society. I'm going to be shunned. I'm going to be blamed. I'm going to be shamed. You know, there's all that energy that around these things that always have that flavor to it, that there's somehow there's a right way to be, and to be right, you have to follow these rules and adhere to these. It takes away agency and replaces it with fear. It takes away our ability just to really feel into some situation and go, ah, just I see what's right here. Because I just have to, instead I can just follow the rules and observances and I don't have to think about it anymore. I never think about anything. I just follow the rules. And I'm not saying the rules and observances aren't all bad. It's just that it takes away our ability to actually see things as they are. Instead, we're just trying to follow the rules. And there's this element of fear, of this sort of wagging finger that's often behind rules and observances. And acting out of fear is never wholesome. Never wholesome. And that's, we're trying to tend towards, lean towards the wholesome all the time. And fear, by in and of itself, is a very unwholesome emotional state. So if we're acting, thinking from that place, we're caught, we're fettered by that fear that comes along with following the rules and observances. Sensual desire. This is, I mean, I don't think about this one. You all know what sensual desire is, right? Whatever your particular kind of sensual desire is, whether it's for, like me, chocolate or whatever, you know, we all have this. And I'm always astonished that I'm sitting, even like whether it's a daily sitting period or on a longer retreat, how often stories, memories of great things that happened in the past or thoughts about things might be in the future. Maybe someone will ship me a whole case of chocolate. I mean, who knows, you know? But whatever that desire is, okay? They're just there. They just pop up in our mind. We might just be sitting there totally concentrated and focused and calm and still and it was, one of those quote good sits, right? And then along comes one of these stories. Totally something that happened 50 years ago. Now for some of us 50 years ago you wouldn't remember, but you know, for a lot some of us here 50 years ago we remember quite clearly. And there it is. Where did that come from? That's called, you know, a latent fetter. It's there waiting just to pop into your mind yet again and catch you. And I'm saying all this just because it fascinates me that that's what goes on in my mind. I presume my mind is not unique. We all have things that we are caught in this way. And it's just, oh, there it is, that latent energy of wanting something that's gone, or it's in the future, but it's not right now. Right now, I'm just having to be sitting. There it is. Incredible to me. And it's like, oh, just being able to notice, oh, this is, look how my thinking about trying to figure out, getting lost in the memory of this, takes me totally out of the present moment. I'm fettered. I'm stuck in this, the sweetness. The thing about sensual desire is it's always also very kind of sweet and juicy. It's like, oh, I sort of like this because it makes me feel happy thinking about it. But if you really look at it, if you really look at any sensual desire that's arisen in the mind, even if at the moment you're going, oh, this is so great, if you look underneath, you'll see discomfort. Because when these things arise, you want them, but you want them right now. But you can't have them right now. Either because, you know, in case of memories, because that's gone. You know, things that I did in my 20s, I'm never going to be able to do again. That's just life, you know, or whatever. Or it's like in the future sometime, but I'm here right now sitting. I can't have it right now. As much as, you know, so it's like it kind of has this sweet overlay with an underlay of sort of anxiety and discontent. Always there with these energies because it's not happening right now, which is what I always want. Ill will, the last of this list of five. Ill will, my little note here, that can be subtle. I mean, think of what ill will we probably all think, oh, you know, I'm basically a good person. I don't have any ill will towards anything or anybody. I'm a good guy. I'm a nice person. Then think of the following scenario. You find out that someone has acted in a way that you find very reprehensible. They, you know, they stole or they did some horrible thing, whatever. Pick your favorite horrible thing. And then they're caught and then they're punished. How often does our mind go, that's okay, they deserve it? That's a thought of ill will. That's a thought of ill will. Like, they deserve to suffer for what they did. I mean, whether or not they actually do deserve that, but it's like, it's a mental state of ill will has arisen, just like that. And we all have things, all have mental habits of certain things that we just sort of go, ah, anybody who does that, they deserve what they get. Whatever your favorite form of disgust is, you know. But it's like that's always coming from a place of ill will. Subtle. But it's not like, but we can't just stop and think, oh, this person must have been so deeply lost in suffering to speak or act in that way. That's the thought of compassion instead. Instead of getting caught up in the they deserve it energy. But it's so, it's also quite socially acceptable to have thoughts of ill will about people who deserve it. So we have to watch for these. This is the subtler things we sometimes have to look at. So, now, here's the big question. Here's all these fetters. We talked about them. How do we work with this stuff? How can we skillfully do something about this? And this is, I'm going to give you my cat answer in some senses. That's what mindfulness is all about. Mindfulness is a solution to deal with the fetters. And I want to read once again something from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness, here. And he's talking very precisely about fetters. If we can recognize not only that the fetter is what the fetter is that arises with a sense contact, that is, whether it is the form of greed or wanting, aversion or dislike, or dull not knowing, but also how we feel it energetically, this can help us notice the arising defilement more quickly. Feeling them directly in this way can motivate and inspire us to let them go, because we are actually experiencing the suffering of them. It is like holding on to a hot coal. Once we're aware of the burning sensation, we don't need much prompting to drop it. This is why over and over and over again, I've heard teachers say, and I've said myself many times, I'm sure, taught students, that when you're caught in one of those mind whirlwinds that we get caught in times, often the most skillful thing to do is sort of step back from the whirlwind as much as you can and instead pay attention to what your body actually feels like in the moment. What does this feel like? Because it's always, when we're in one of those whirlwinds, it's going to be unpleasant. And it's like, oh, see how that whirlwind, that story, that whatever, is unpleasant. And it's unwholesome because it's making my body feel this way. It's like my body's telling me everything I need to know right now. And that's what makes us, you know, like he says, we take the hot coal and we drop it. Oh, I don't need this, hold on to this story. I don't need to hold on to this idea. I don't need to hold on to this belief, this view, whatever it is that's causing my mind to whirl. Because look what it's doing. It's always, at some level, creating physical, and at some level, we're also looking at the sort of the purely mental, what's underneath. Because often those stories, like stories of anger, you know, where we're ranting about something, blah, 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 blah. So if we look underneath, not only is it uncomfortable on the body level, but anger is often very much sitting right on top of fear. Because when we're afraid of something, then we get angry, because we don't like being afraid. And if we can sort of look below the story and see the raw fear that's often underneath that ranting energy, that can also be very skillful. You can say, oh, that's what's going on. And fear always feels really unpleasant in the body. It's always going to be, you know, really tense and locked. So we can, you know, part of this, what he's talking about, like feeling them directly, is to see below the story what's really pushing this. Fear is often right at the top of the list. Doubt is, in a sense, a form of fear in that sense. One more good. Now the good news. Now I've given you all the bad news, but there is good news here as well. This is once again from Joseph's book, and he's talking about enlightenment and what that means in a sense. And this is, first of all, here's a quote. This is from the Sutta. This is the Buddha talking. There is, monks, an unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned. No self, in other words, right? If, monks, there were no unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned, no escape would be discerned from what is born, become, made and conditioned, i.e. this life. But because there is an unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned, therefore escape is discerned from what is born, become, made and conditioned. It's basically saying you can overcome identity view. That's what he's basically saying here in very precise terms. And he's saying, this is now just these moments of consciousness that take nibbana, this enlightenment, as their object. In other words, as we're meditating, we have these moments where pure enlightened energy arises. And it might be like that, or it might even hang around for 2 or 3 seconds, and for some of us, maybe 5 or 10 seconds, who knows? It's these moments that are the fruition of the practice. This is called a path moment, likened to a sudden flash of lightning that illuminates the sky, has power to completely uproot certain defilements, certain fetters from the mind. You know, have those moments of enlightenment, and a fetter is uprooted. I love that image. Like it's if a fetter is attached to a tree, you know, you're and now the tree, the thing that's holding you in place, is uprooted. It's not like it sort of fell over and you have to sort of figure out how to get around. It's gone. It's uprooted. Has the power to completely uproot certain defilements from the mind so that they don't arise again, or to weaken the defilement that remains. So these, all of these fetters are weakened or uprooted directly by experience that arises through practice. That's the good news. You know, that we're not permanently fettered, that we're not stuck. And it isn't like, oh yeah, that's for some advanced person. That's every time we practice, we have these potential to have these moments of clear insight. It's called insight meditation. Like, we have these clear, sure moments of insight that arise in our practice. What we're doing is, if we're not uprooting them, then we're certainly weakening them. These fetters have less power over us until one day we actually uproot them. That's the nature of the practice. And then, this is what we get. This is from Dana Fald's book, Going and In. This is an ecstatic poem in the dualistic tradition, but it sums things up quite nicely, I think. Touch me as you seek to find the core of my desire. Come to me like the wind before a summer storm. Blown open, I close no doors against the breeze. Dance with me beneath the clouds. Find me within you, above you, beside you. When the rain finally falls, I cannot tell where you end and I begin. No self anymore. No more identity of you. When the rain finally falls, I cannot tell where you end and I begin. Fetters and unfetters, or breaking them, the fetters. That's what this practice is. Like seeing the fetters and then setting about to quite consciously do something about them and break them. Over a long period of time, perhaps, we're going to chip away, we're going to loosen them a little bit, and uproot them, pull up one little piece of the root, and then more and then more and then more. So that's all I